Hey, how's it going, Chads?
Good day,
GM,
sir.
GM.
How are you?
Australian Chad.
Hi, Chad. I've just hacked his Twitter account.
Is that how the Australian?
No, that's more British. I think. Not that I'm an expert.
Yeah,
I think
Cockney accent.
Probably insult this one British person in the audience who's now angry with me. I probably insulted them. The Aussies are more like, good day, mate. They're kind of more of a hopped speech, in a sense.
I don't know. Sounded like that to me the first time. Sounded about
well,
the same.
They are similar. I'll give you that.
They are.
Any other accents or impressions you
oh,
got?
Oh, gosh. This is going to be embarrassing. I think one of my favorite ones is like the Irish accent, because it always goes up at the end and back down. Like, it always just has this like kind of movement that it goes.
Oh,
and they
yeah.
just have words like they don't say Ireland, they say like Oiland, like oi.
Ireland.
Ireland. Like, it just is this weird kind of like movement up and down. That's just they're not monotone. They're never monotone. They always gotta go like, you know, all around the place. And the same thing with Scotland, because Scotland's like an Irish accent, but like times 10. They just go even more extreme in their sways and the tone. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and we're over here just sounding like a bunch of morons too.
Yeah, we're very nasal. To the rest of the English-speaking world, we're very like, you know, nasally in the way we sound. Because we say like, you know, like water, and they're like water. Is that more rounded sound, like tone to it?
Yeah, unless you're from Philly, then it's wooter.
Wooter. From New York, it's water.
All
right, I'm done insulting people now.
All right, so
that's what the people are here for.
Hear me shit talk and do really bad impressions of accents.
Accents and impressions day.
Hey, man.
If anyone comes up and asks a question, you could do it in a random. An accent from around the world.
I made my computer language, not so much human languages. So I'm probably one of the worst people in the world to do that.
Yeah,
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time. We did have Borat up here that one time.
Oh yeah, that was awesome. we do have a couple Irish people in the community. I don't remember.
Yep,
someone come on board with a thick Irish accent.
Yeah, someone from the community is an Irish tattoo artist, and he did a sick. Like veneer threads skateboard with the shoes on it and stuff like that. It's super cool. Shout out to, I want to say it's Jat Nasi is how you pronounce the name. Just super talented tattoo artist out of Dublin or somewhere around there. hit up the Thor Chad tattoo artist if you're from the area.
I wonder how many people have rune tattoos. There's got to be someone.
All right, let's get into Savers. So it looks like Savers rollout is officially happening. It looks like the node vote passed last night. So Savers, let's go through the rollout plan. So I think at this point, just waiting for front ends to get some of their UIs together, so that way there can be like a very usable interface. And I know that Thor Wallet and Thor Swap are working on different front-end interfaces for the Savers Vault feature. So, yeah, is there anything else to the rollout of Savers Vault, Chad?
No, that's mostly it. I think the dev team wants to do another round of like internal testing, just to like, you know, verify some things and so forth and so on. So, assuming no bugs or issues are found and the, you know, UIs roll out their UIs, then, you know, we'll be seeing happen fairly soon.
And you could actually deposit in the pools right now. It's possible to just do a Savers deposit. There's just no front end for it yet. So if you're trying to get in early, it's very, very possible to do so. I've tested it out already. There's a couple Savers in the Bitcoin and ETH pools.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it just because it's you're just going to put capital there just to sit there and do nothing. It's not going to earn you any yield or any of these things. So nor are you going to get a better yield because you jumped in earlier or anything like this. So it's like there's no real monetary reason to do so. I mean, if you can, if you really want to, if it floats your boat, but like, that's not really a strong benefit to it.
No, just the flex of being one of the first Savers on
Dark
Chain.
If you want to flex away.
So yeah, to start off, it'll just be on for Bitcoin. Let's go through some of the different there's no configurable parameters around single sided deal. That's just on and off, right? There's really no tinkering around that we have to do in there to make sure all the settings are right. It's just yield is on, and then savers start earning yield when LPs do.
Yeah. Yep.
It's so simple. Like, there's not even that much to go with it. There's nothing you got to do. You just deposit and you just get yield. So what else is there to do?
Yeah, that's part of like the desire to have this feature. One of the main things is the cognitive simplicity of it, right? Like, making things really complicated for people to understand what they're investing into is obviously a barrier to entry, which creates, you know, obviously less people contributing to the liquidity of the network. But if you give them something that's very cognitively simple, like you just deploy an asset and you get yield on that asset, and there's no, you don't have to worry about like crazy things like increment loss and these other kind of wackadoo things that are conceptually, those things and by themselves are very like complicated, are hard to understand the mathematics behind those things. And you know, most people aren't going to really understand the details of how IL works, and they'll get confused one day because like their yield is down for some reason. They're like, why am I at a negative all of a sudden? I was up $200 yesterday, but now I'm like down $50. Like, what the hell is happening here? Like, it's just confusing and like a bad UX. But it was savers, it's like kind of the inverse of that. It's more of like, oh, I put in one Bitcoin and now it's like, you know, one point something, and now, oh, next day it's one point something plus something. And it's just, you know, every day just the number is basically increasing. And you know, it'll change the amount it's increasing per day based upon market conditions and what have you. But like, but at least it's just going in a single direction for the most part. The only way you actually lose your yield in savings is just from entrance and exits. Like, you know, entering the savers, you pay slip fees to enter it, and they pay slip fees on the way out. That's the only cases or scenarios where you walk out with less.
The yield could go to effectively like zero though, if the IL is really high, right? It just wouldn't go negative. You can't lose other than
right
stage.
Right, like you might have a day where your yield for the day is zero, right? That's theoretically possible, but it's not going to go, you know, from one Bitcoin to not 0.99 Bitcoin like it would for IL.
Right, like you're not giving up what you've already earned. Like, it doesn't go backwards.
Correct. It doesn't go backwards.
Yeah.
It doesn't go backwards. Correct.
There's also an open space. Anyone can come up and request. We already have a question from TMT Capital. Hey.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Can you hear me? Cool. I haven't been too active or joining these for quite a while, honestly, since like the whole Luna fucking fiasco, but never got rid of my Rune. I have it LP'd with USD, but the savers thing, I wanted to join this because it sounds awesome, and I do have Bitcoin that's sitting on my ledger, and I'm wondering what the process would be to, well, A, if I can utilize the ledger for this, and B, what the process would be to, in a sense, get started on that, and when that can happen.
Yeah, you can definitely use the ledger. And so once the, like, you know, let's take the ThorSwap, for example, like a good example for this case. Once the ThorSwap UI supports it and the feature is enabled and everything's kind of live, whatever, then you would just go into ThorSwap UI, you would connect your wallet, which in this case would be a ledger, and you would, you know, select the Bitcoin pool and hit, you know, add to savers or where the UI is going to be. I have no idea. I haven't seen it myself. And then it just makes a transaction from your ledger to the network, and then away you go.
Okay, that's easy enough. And then as far as like adding the Bitcoin into it, I assume you're going to need some sort of, is it Rune? Is it a Rune transaction fee, or is it just taken out of the Bitcoin directly? Or
no, everything's in Bitcoin. So everything gets taken right out of the original Bitcoin deposit. I would just leave just a little bit, enough for gas, so that way you can withdraw whenever you're done with your position, unless you want to add more to your Bitcoin wallet to withdraw. Okay, because you do need to send another, like a small like gas transaction around like a little bit more than 10,000 sats to withdraw. Okay. So as long as you keep that in your wallet to take it out at a future time, then you just withdraw the layer one Bitcoin later. It's all just on the BTC blockchain.
Yeah, you could literally technically even do it without an interface. All you need is your Bitcoin wallet, and you're just sending it to another Bitcoin wallet that ThorChain controls with a memo, and then the same thing to withdraw. But yeah, on ThorSwap, it'll be super simple. I've seen what's coming. We're really trying to make it just as simplified as possible. So, you know, there isn't a whole lot of info. It's just like, what's the APR?
Right.
You know, what asset are you depositing? Click deposit, sign it. It'll show you Well, it'll display like the slippage for entering. You need to understand that aspect, but you know, it'll show what you deposited, how much you've earned, what's withdrawable, withdraw button. Really, that's kind of all you need for it. And yeah, you can connect Ledger directly to ThorSwap, or if you like using Ledger with XDeFi, you can connect that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I currently use XDeFi for the Rune BUSD, but that's all sounds pretty easy. I mean, obviously it's too early to know, but I mean, any estimates on what this type of yield would look like, or is it just dependent upon how deep it is and how many people are participating?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to guess these things because it's based upon market conditions. And so it depends what the market, how the market reacts to the feature. My assumption, and I could be wrong about this, is the yield's going to be rather low just because you're giving people decentralized yield on Bitcoin, which is basically a first in our industry. And the demand for that feature will probably be high because the demand is high. The yield will naturally reflect the demand, right? So like in an inverse way. So if the demand is really high, the yield will naturally be low, right? So I'm not expecting the yield to be like bonkers high. I'm expecting it to be bonkers low, if anything. This is my guess of what's
going to happen. Yeah, that makes sense.
We don't really know what it's going to be. Like I'd be like maybe a percent, like 1% yield, like maybe that'd be pretty mm-hmm. good, or like maybe 0.5%. Like that's what I'm going to be guessing. Like, but obviously it just depends on, you know, the market to figure out what the yield
better
should
than
be.
Zero.
Yeah.
And it'll be roughly half of what the dual-sided LP is, right? So I know there's a little bit of funny math around that where it's not exactly half, but roughly half is probably a good heuristic for people.
But you also have to consider that's at the current depth, at the current right. swap rates, right? So as the depth increases, that yield goes down. But as volumes increase, then that yield goes up. So really, it is completely dependent on volumes and the depth of the pool, which the depth of the pool will likely be increasing a lot because a lot of people will be depositing. But you know, we're also doing work to increase the volume too. So it really depends on where things go and you know, in what direction on that front.
Right. And as the pool depths increase, the sentiment pendulum swings toward away from the pools and towards the nodes. So nodes will start earning a higher yield. Like I'm expecting the nodes yield to go up significantly as part of this feature, and the pools yield to go down in general, just because the market is pushing a lot of capital into the pools, which just naturally causes the yield to go more towards the nodes and away from the pools. So I think that's probably going to happen as well, is my guess. But again, we don't really know until the market responds.
Yeah, and then volume, you know, with all the efforts on integrations and things like that, like that's the real lever, because you know, maybe you can have 10 times, 100 times more people, more liquidity earning that same 1% or whatever. Like that all of those added fees are what's going to support that and allow it to scale up and let more people in at the same rate.
Right.
Like the rate will probably self-regulate based on what you were describing, Chad, like just like what the market determines is the appropriate rate. But then the more swaps are funding that, the larger that pool can be at that same rate.
Right. Like each individual person needs to look at this situation and say to themselves, of like, okay, let's say the Bitcoin yields at like 0.5%, let's just say, right, for the sake of discussion. And, you know, you're not taking on any price risk. You're not taking on any, like, you know, other risks other than protocol risk, right? You're taking on protocol risk. You're giving the network your Bitcoin and the risk the protocol has towards that Bitcoin, or whatever those risks may be, like another exploit, for example, or some sort of bug, blah, 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 like whatever it might be. Like there's always the protocol risk, no matter what DeFi app that you're talking about, right? And so you have to ask yourself the question of like, oh, okay, what is the protocol risk? Like, what is the value of that protocol risk in your head? Like, whatever you think the likelihood of there being an issue or not. And then there's also like, what is the yield? Okay, 0.5%, 1%, 1,000%, like whatever the hell that number is going to be. And everybody just has to make a determination for themselves of like, oh, you know, the protocol risk is too high for 0.5%, but like if it's, you know, 1%, that's probably worthwhile for me. And someone else might say something the inverse of that or whatever, right? Like everybody's got to make their own determinations for themselves. And then the free market will determine what the yield of this asset, this savers for Bitcoin, for example, should be, just probably the free market saying, I think this is worth the risk of the protocol. I want that X number of yield. And another person saying, I don't want it, so I'm going to go ahead and leave or not join to begin with. And then eventually just the market just kind of figures out the correct answer, whatever that is.
Cool. Hope that was able to answer your question. If other people have questions about the dynamics of, you know, how this stuff works, or, you know, how you'll be able to deposit or whatever, you just hit the request button and pop up. Thanks, TMT.
Yeah, I don't know if it's too nuanced to get into right here. Maybe we need some diagrams, but there is a lot of confusion just around like how that yield is calculated. Anything you want to try to simplify on that?
So nothing that we'll be able to do in voice, I don't think. So yield is calculated with LUVI. LUVI is liquidity unit value index, and there's a Medium article that was put out on this over the summer. It's a way to calculate the yield of a pool that is irrespective of price. So the price of the individual assets don't actually matter. It just this number only goes up once more value is added to the pools. So once there's swap fees or block rewards that come into the pools, that LUVI value goes up. But the actual price movements don't make so much of a difference. I believe the price ratios do, and IL does play a factor there. But the actual prices of the assets themselves don't actually matter for this LUVI score so much. This is a new metric that's what's currently used to determine the APRs in the pools. Like if you go to ThorSwap right now and you look at the APRs, what ThorSwap does, I believe, is it looks at the LUVI value for the Bitcoin pool. It looks at the LUVI value from 180 days ago, from the longest period that it looks at, I believe, is 180 days, and then it looks at the LUVI value today and says, okay, what's the difference between the LUVI value 180 days ago and today? And then it says, all right, that's the yield for the last 6 months. So what does that look like if you stay in the pool for a year? So that just doubles the LUVI value. So it doubles that gain, that percentage gain. So over a 6 month period, the LUVI value must have increased about 1.2% because the APR is about 2% right now on ThorSwap. So you could look at any other pool, and I believe it selects the longest possible period for an asset that has a LUVI score, like a newer asset like Atom, which has only been around for 2 or 3 months. That's not using 180 days of data because there aren't 180 days of data on ThorSwap, but something like Bitcoin, ETH, that's all using long-term data, and then it's all calculated with LUVI. So it's not actually using the pool prices because the math gets a little funky once you start getting into asset prices and things like that, and switching from ETH to Rune or whatever. So it just uses LUVI. Check out that article on LUVI if you're interested in learning about how the yield is actually calculated.
Yeah, LUVI itself is kind of a difficult thing to understand. It's a difficult thing to describe and explain. So kind of at some level, like, requires you just to dive into the math yourself to kind of understand the nuances of it. But like, maybe one way to describe it, and hopefully this is doing it justice or whatever, but is that like LUVI attempts to figure out like how much fees have been collected in this pool. And it doesn't matter if the Bitcoin price went up or the Rune price went down or whatever. It's just irrespective to the price movements of the various assets in the network. It's trying to say, okay, at this point in time, the pool's like not value, but like let's position was this. And then a week later, it's now higher, right? And that difference between those two numbers is like trying to express how much yield was generated in this pool, right? Like at a high level, that's basically what's happening to a certain extent, right? And so by using that kind of idea, like, oh, okay, the pool, grew by, 2% due to the yield. From that number, we can kind of figure out how much of that 2% yield should the savers get, and then do some quick math, figure that out, and then like mint some cents to the savers. I'm like, here's your yield. You're up only interest that's happening here. The problem though with LUVI though, and something we've been kind of like struggling with for a long time in some sense, is that like LUVI worked extremely well, actually perfectly well, before there were cents. Like the way its way of expressing the yield generated within a pool over a period, any given period of time from point A to point B, worked extremely well and very effective. But as soon as we added cents in situation, that really kind of, with like dynamic units and all these things, so like that really kind of changed the effectiveness of LUVI because like it kind of could be skewed in one direction or the other direction depending upon how many synth units had changed over the time period of whatever, right? So that's always been kind of like we've been looking for months now, and nobody's been able to come up with a new way of calculating LUVI that accounts for synth price changes and like this kind of stuff. So like, that's something it's another area of like mathematical research that I think myself and other people are interested in, trying to figure out a new way of calculating Luby that's more effective and more efficient than the current one we have. But for right now, I think it's what would be work. It works well enough for what we need, and we can kind of move forward with it. And then, you know, hopefully improve it as time goes on.
Yeah, Luby is one of those complicated little things, and it brings into question like something that we've been discussing. And I know, Pluto's been talking about this. Like, how do you actually display the yield, and what is the? I'm curious to get your guys' take, or people in the audience, if people have opinions on this, you can definitely come up and let us know. So the way that ThorSwap does it, as I said before, it looks at the longest possible period for the pool, up to 180 days, I believe. And so what you're looking at in that yield is reflected in, it's a long-term period of data, where the alternative is look at, say, the last 30 days of yield. And obviously that's a lot more volatile, and it could go, it could be, very close to zero, or it could go zero or negative over a short period of time, just because of impermanent loss in the pool. So looking at long-term periods of data gives a better view on what a long-term LP would be experiencing, but it also misses out on that short volatility, when things start changing rapidly, that number doesn't change as quickly, because it's looking at a very long sample period of, 180 days of data, looking back to April at this point, where you'd be looking at that like 2.5% number for the Bitcoin yields, or, you look at the past 30 days and it's more like 5%. If you were to extrapolate out that, if the performance of the past 30 days continued for the next year, you'd be looking at like 5% yield on the Bitcoin pool. So it really depends on time frame. And, I'm curious to get people's takes on what is better for the user. Is it to get that longer time period where people you get more data from the past, or is it better to get that shorter time period to more accurately reflect the recent yields in the pool of the past month rather than the past 6 months? What do you guys think?
My opinion is just longer time frames better. It's more, if you're trying to make a determination to like put your Bitcoin into savers, for example, and earn yield on it, you're probably not, at least you probably are thinking in the context of a long-term investment. Like, you're probably not going to like, oh, I'm going to put it in for like 16 hours and then pull it out. Like, that wouldn't make much sense. And so you're probably, especially in a bear market where you just want to park your capital somewhere and just let it earn yield for the next 2 years while we're still trying to work through the bear market and eventually get back into the bulls. But like, so because your investment is like on a long-term horizon, you should take a long-term horizon of like how you look at it, the yield. Like, so that makes the most sense to me. But there's also this other caveat of like, when you look at a long-term investment, a long-term like calculating the yield, there's a lot of things that happened in those 6 months or in those 1 year or whatever the time frame is that can also change and manipulate the yield for those 12 months or so 6 months. And so it's like, just because the last 6 months were, X yield doesn't mean the next 6 months are also going to be X yield. Like, obviously there's no correlation there, like no strong correlation. It's because markets can go bull again, markets can get more bear, right? And all these things can affect the yield of a particular pool. So it's like, at some level, like the longer time frame you look out from in the past of how much yield it is, it's probably the reasonable best way of view of knowing what the future yield may be, or like the best guess you can reasonably make. But obviously nobody ever really knows what the yield's going to be in the next 12 months.
Exactly. In the end, all it really tells you is this was the yield of the past 6 months, not this will be the yield of the next 6 months or the next year. It's past looking, not forward looking. Although, right. Like, it's people think of APY as this forward looking thing, but it's actually a backwards looking metric that looks at the yield of the past and says, like, if this exact performance were to continue, or if you entered at this time, 6 months ago, this is what your yield would be, not like this is what your yield will be going forward.
Yeah, that's why I'm torn, because ideally what people really want is to know exactly what they're about to earn, right? Like, that's the one thing they want to know when they're entering the pool. Yeah, fixed rate. But I mean, even people are used to like incentivized degen LPs and stuff, and it's like, oh, it's earning 700% right now, like I'll just get in for like a day until it goes down or whatever, and like that's definitely not how these numbers are displayed. If it's backwards looking, and especially if it's like 6 months backwards looking. But at the same time, I understand that that's like more accurate and less spiky and volatile just based on like, you know, doing a really short time period. But yeah, I'm kind of torn because of that.
Yeah, there's also there's a middle ground too. Like you could do like a 90 day pool, like a, you know, that would be basically a quarterly view of what the yield would be looking at the last quarter of data. Like how does that look? If that quarter's performance is repeated for the next four, then that's what the yield is. So like, I don't know, that's just like a, yeah. but that's a huge thing. Cause that's the number that everyone sees when they go on the site. They're like, oh, this is the yield for the Bitcoin pool. And, right. Do you want that to be a volatile number, or would you rather that be like a low, smooth, flat number, or what?
It would also miss extreme changes, right? Like kind of like what Chad was saying, but like hypothetically, like what if the Bitcoin pool depth 100x'd and then it was still displaying like the trailing average? That would be off by like many orders of magnitude, right? But I don't know, what can you do?
Yeah, so someone made a great dashboard for this actually, to look at the like the charts of the APRs, and it kind of helps me visualize at least the difference between like a 30 day look back period and like 180 day look back period, or anything in between. It's on thorchain.net. So if you go to thorchain.net/insights/APR, or you just navigate on the side on thorchain.net, there's a really great chart. You can click any pool that's on Thorchain, and then you can change the look back period from 30 days to 60 days to 90 days to 180 days. And you can see what the APR looks like. And you can kind of see how that changes over time. And when you change the period, how that messes with the charts just based on the sample period. And hopefully that can give people a better idea of like what it means when APR is like backwards looking and kind of tries to fit together a lot of different data from the past that might not be may or may not be what happens in the future.
By the way, like when people are in savers, like they get their yield gets paid out like in a cycle, like or could call it an epoch. Some people call it an epoch in this industry. So instead of getting a continuous yield, like you do in as a regular LP as you do today, like you enter and you leave 5 minutes later and you get whatever yield you got within that 5 minutes, whatever that would be. Here it's just like it's paying out yield to savers like on a routine. Probably it's going to be like 24 hours. I'm not really quite sure. I have to have a conversation with the dev team, with the Nine Realms team, to figure out what makes the most sense. My leaning is personal leaning is probably like closer to like once a day. The network will just figure out what the yield is and then pay savers what they're owed. But maybe the best way to calculate yield is actually looking at the daily payouts of savers over the time span of like, let's just call it 90 days or like, you know, 6 months or whatever. And then instead of taking the average of those days and averaging out and that being your number, maybe it makes most sense just to do a median of those days. So instead of doing like averaging it out, you're looking at like the most frequently used number within the daily emissions of yield for those savers. And that way you're basically eliminating oddities. So you're eliminating, if there was one day with like, just say one day had like $1 trillion of income, right? And an average, you would look at this the last 6 days and you say, oh, I got like, you know, 1.00001 trillion yield divided by, you know, 60 days, whatever, or 90 days, whatever the number is, and then be like, oh, the yield's this crazy high number. In reality, there's only, whoa, that startled me there. The reality is it's not that number. Reality is like that was just one day that was an anomaly in the situation, and we shouldn't really like look at that as part of the yield, because it's just one day that something happened in the markets that caused that to happen. But there's no reason, maybe there's not likely to happen or a reason to believe that it would happen in the future. And so instead you look at the average, you look at the median, and then it gives you maybe a more fair or more reasonably minded way of looking at the yield of the savers accounts.
Interesting. Yeah, but if you're doing the median though, I guess I would need to see like what that looks like on the data. Because I mean, it's just a different way of calculating it than which way does that skew that? Like, you know, every single like method of calculation has like some kind of like drawback. And the other thing is like all these other services, I don't know if they're open about like how they actually what periods do they look back on? How do they actually calculate their yields and things like that? So like, I feel like that, like everyone that's in this space, they have like, kind of everyone has their own expectation, which does not necessarily align to the reality of how every single service, like include like something like Coinbase is like custodial earn service. How do they calculate their yield in their app? Like they display some kind of number where, you know, you deposit this many ETH and they give you maybe like, you know, 4 or 5%. How do they calculate that 4 or 5%? Where is that number coming from? What is the what determines that number? And I'm sure everyone here has an idea of how they do that, but no one knows exactly how they do that. So this is just, you know, it's an open conversation. If people have strong opinions or like would like to say something about how they think of the yield, that could be helpful to us. So under consideration. Also, for the record, I thought that that flingy emoji, I thought that was gonna be like a cash register sound emoji for when there's $1 trillion a yield, but it just turned into a flinging emoji.
I don't know why, but that sound was extremely loud in my earbuds. I don't know if it was just me or whatever, but like it just startled the fuck out of me. I was like, what the fuck? Yeah, that's it. Loud as shit in my ears. I don't know why. Anybody got anything you want to bring up? Questions from the audience? Q&A? Ask me anything? AMA?
I don't know if Pluto wants to come up and talk about the yields a little bit, because I know that's something we were talking a little bit about, just like the design of it and just making it, you know, because there needs to be a default somewhere, like a default value that's displayed in Midgard. And I pinned up the old Luvi and Midgard APR calculation article from the summer. So if you're actually interested in like how the APR is calculated and learning about Luvi and stuff like that, you can just click that. And that was a conversation we had over the summer, trying to figure out how do we more accurately display pool yields, and this is what we ended up with. So this is the result of that, and now we got savers, so we can use Luvi for that too. So it's useful knowledge to have if you're way too deep into this space for your own good. So yeah, anything else on savers?
I don't think there's anything else on savers, unless anybody else wants to ask a question or whatever. We can move on to a different topic.
So is yield going to be enabled the same time that interfaces are launching and there's kind of like more of a, not official, but semi-official sort of launch? Is that the plan? Because the vote already passed 2/3, right? But then that's just a symbolic vote, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the reason why we had a symbolic vote, like you could have done just directly, just have it be enabled by the community directly, and that would have been fine, of course. But the reason why we did a symbolic vote is just because we wanted the Mimir admin to be able to turn off the feature like immediately if there was, say, we found some bug or some exploit or some issue, like, you know, tomorrow or whatever, it doesn't matter. We wanted the ability to disable that feature very quickly and then fix the bug and then carry on. If the nodes had voted to turn it on, then we would have required the nodes to vote to turn it off. And that would, of course, would have taken, you know, hours, like 6 hours, 12 hours, 24, like who knows, like whatever the quantity of hours would be required. And so that we want to have a more quicker and faster response to any bugs or issues that are found, especially in the beginning when there's obviously more likely to be issues and bugs in the beginning because it's a brand new feature, you know, so kind of getting its kind of sea legs in the matter of speaking. I think over time, though, like maybe in 6 months or so, if the nodes just wanted to vote on this, have another vote and just to take over the control of the flag that enables and disables this feature, the feature flag, they can do that. That's fine. But I think in the beginning, it's just to be cautious, to be slow, to be, you know, more on the responsible side of launching like a major new feature. We want to make sure that we have the ability to like have full control over that feature in the initial days to make sure if there's any issues we can respond quickly and efficiently and minimize any effects.
Can't argue with that. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Oh, in terms of timing, yes, the timing. We want to wait for the UIs to be ready and available, and so we're waiting for confirmation from various UIs to kind of let us know when they're ready to go. Internally within the dev team, we have more testing we want to do and verification of some things. We also need to have conversations about like some of the Mimir aspects or the kind of like the levers on the feature. Like, okay, do we want to do, you know, that whole epoch thing I mentioned earlier? Do we want to do like once a day or once a week or once a 6 hours or what? And there's like a handful of those kind of controls or little levers we want to kind of discuss internally and to figure out what we feel is a reasonable way to start it for first launch purposes. And then, I think at that point we'd be ready. We can go ahead and enable the feature and all that kind of stuff. So probably won't happen today, I'm assuming. I don't think the UIs will be ready today, but next week I hope to see it.
Yeah, I think ThorSwap will definitely be ready after the weekend from what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yep.
So early.
That'd be great.
Hey, Donku.
Hey, gentlemen. Thank you for bringing me up and congrats for being so close to finally launch the saving vaults. I think even if right now we're in the bear market and maybe not everybody's paying attention, I think this is a huge step forward, as you also mentioned before. So really much looking forward to it. And Chad, thank you for kind of discussing a bit on the Discord, right? Kind of what is now the APR? Let's see what it finally is. It's really not that easy, and also the Luby stuff. But I think that stuff that's not relevant for people, right? Ultimately, it's like they need a good APR. They need to feel comfortable with it. So what I would like to ask you to you guys is like, do you see any problems with that the APR, maybe for example on the Bitcoin vault is too low at the moment, right? Because I guess it would be just very low, around maybe 1 or 2%. So do you see there a challenge in people then joining the vault and saying, yes, let's do it, let's use it? Or do you have any thoughts around this?
I mean, I would prefer, if I had a magic wand, I could do whatever the hell I wanted. I would prefer to launch this thing with a very low yield on purpose, just because we don't want to create like a frenzy on day one. Like, we don't want to say like, oh, the yield's 80%. If I can enforce 80% yield on Savers magically somehow and do that, I still wouldn't want to do that, just because we want to launch it with a low yield to get, you know, a handful of people engaged with it, you know, so to speak, or a lower quantity of people, just so that we can, it gives us time to kind of like find some, you know, issues or bugs and kind of squash those issues before we, like, you know, huge quantities of people and huge quantities of capital just kind of YOLO'd into the system. Generally speaking, we always try to launch things slowly, like main features as slow as we reasonably can, just to make sure that we don't have any major issues or bugs in the early days. And then once we feel more comfortable and confident that's all working as planned and everything's right and everything's kind of leveling out the way we want it to level out, we feel confident about that, then we can kind of like increase that stuff. But the yield, like, we don't have control of the yield at all. I don't have any, other than the context of one of the mirrors allows the network to control the yield. Right now that's set to 50%. So if you put in $100 of the value, your $100 is earning, you know, another $100, let's say. And so instead of taking back that $100 that you earned, you take back 50%. And so if we wanted to, we could start off the yield at a lower than 50%. We could do like 30% or 20% or you know, arbitrarily whatever number we wanted to, just to enforce a smaller yield in the earlier days to give us like more time of just testing the feature in the real world and with real economics and math and all these things and to make sure everything is, you know, working accordingly.
Part of that dynamic too is how bullish are people on Rune, right? Because they can still dual side LP and earn more overall, and then also have potential upside in the Rune asset. And like, the market has already spoken and driven the yield quite low in the BTC pool because you can't get yield on BTC basically anywhere else. And the people in the network right now want that exposure to Rune, right? So it's like already one of the lowest pools. So yeah, I think that plays part two, is if you want exposure to Rune, then you're still probably going to do that if you have a bunch of Rune.
Yeah. Like I said before, like, we still have to have conversations internally in the dev team about those, like, the mere levers, and that yield lever that I was referring to is one of those levers, right? And so we had to, I think we were, yeah, we still have to have conversations about that kind of stuff. But good question to ask, though.
Brought up Andres. Hey.
Good morning, everyone. First of all, kudos to all the entire team. You guys are doing an amazing job. You all are hustlers, and I love it. So my question is, many more traditional financial institutions are coming into the industry. They are offering crypto to retail investors. My first question is, do you think that's a threat, or is there a concern for the decentralized exchanges? And my second question is, do you guys see an opportunity here maybe to integrate Torchain's services and products on the back end of these big financial institutions? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't see it as a threat in the least, just because what we're doing, what we're accomplishing here, is not something that can be reproduced within the centralized world. Like, they can't. They always require, will always require KYC, and they always require these things. And so tons of people could be coming, and tons of institutions can be coming, but they're still going to be obliged to obey the same set of rules as everybody else that preceded them. So more doesn't really matter. We're already just doing something that is kind of disjointed from the quantity of institutions. So I'm not terribly concerned about that. In fact, I'd be bullish about it, because it just means that more people will hold crypto, and more people will likely opt to use a free and open and transparent system over a closed black box and controlled system over the long term. What's the second question again?
Whether Thorchain would be implemented into the back end of some of these financial institutions?
That's a good question. I would hope so. It's hard. It's kind of hard to say, because I don't know what the regulatory requirements are for them. So it is possible, for example, like a Galaxy Digital, for example, if they wanted to trade on Thorchain, because the capital they're interfacing with, the LP that they're interfacing with, is not KYC capital, does that mean that they are not able to trade or interact in some way? That's a kind of a gray area. That some people say yes to that question, and some people say no to that question. And of course, as the SEC always does, just doesn't say anything at all. And it makes it, you know, very hard to understand what the actual rules are. So to me, it's like, they will do it when it makes sense, and they will do it when it doesn't make sense. And because of the lack of regulatory, you know, clarity, it's hard to know whether something does or does not make sense. If that makes sense.
Thank you.
To read a little deeper into that question, I do think that when you say financial institutions, I'm just talking about just crypto projects in general, and people that would be interested in having access to Thorchain's liquidity. And then I think the answer to that is a resounding yes, that institutions and apps and services will continue to integrate Thorchain, just as we've seen the past couple of months. A ton of interest in getting Thorchain just as rails to do native asset swaps in the background, because we're the only service that could that can do this, really. We think there's going to be a ton of interest going forward, just getting Thorchain swapped on, especially with yield. All of these products are like really desirable for all these institutions, because there's so many gatekeepers in this industry that they all want to cut, and they all require obviously things like KYC. And this is the only way that you can implement these things without those requirements or going through those centralized services. This is the only permissionless way to implement Bitcoin swaps on your non-custodial wallet, for example, or DEXs. I think we'll see a lot of stuff like that in the near future, as we've been seeing the past couple of months.
Okay, that responds my question. Thank you, guys.
Cool. So, yes. So after Savings Vaults, which is obviously the next exciting thing, we all can't wait for that. And then there's a protocol on liquidity, which kind of works in there with Savers Vaults. So there is some capacity for Savers Vaults before protocol and liquidity starts coming into play. But so Chad, what are you thinking about with the rollout to protocol and liquidity? Like when we actually turn that on? Is that like when we start reaching the caps, or like probably after we enable a couple of pools for the Savers Vaults, we up it from just Bitcoin to others, or kind of how do you think about that? Also, yeah, that is something that we didn't talk about. When is it that we actually start stepping up Savers and going to other pools like ETH, BNB, Doge, or whatever?
Well, so Savers will be, when we launch it, it'll be available in all of the gas assets. So like one asset per chain, which is the primary asset per chain. POL will be maybe a little bit different from that, possibly. But so when we launch Savers, people can start adding Bitcoin to their heart's content until it hits some sort of cap. Like, for example, Bitcoin, the cent utilization for Bitcoin relative to the pool depth is like 2.5%, right? And the limit right now is set to I think it's 15%, I want to say. Or maybe, I can't remember, maybe 30%. I can't remember off the top of my head. But so that's a lot of space for savers to come in. And when they do that, you know, they create a lot of buy pressure on the Rune asset, which is always great, of course. So I guess we're just going to launch it and then wait a little bit, see how the like market responds to the feature. If we start seeing that we're starting to hit the synth cap on a bunch of the pools, like Bitcoin, for example, or ETH or whatever, then we can start to have a conversation about like enabling POL specifically for those pools that kind of deem it the demand is there for. And when we do that, I think we're going to do that in a more of a cautious way. So we'll limit the amount of Rune that the reserve is allowed to deploy into those pools we choose are worth it. And it'll be very slow in how it deploys that Rune. Like it won't be very fast. It'll be very, very, very slow. And then over time, as we feel more comfortable or confident in the math at all and everything's working the way we expect it to work and there's no bugs or whatever, then we can kind of like ramp things up over time. But I think the intention is, though, that like if we were to go to the POL, we would want to push the synth cap to 50% of the pool depth, right? And the reason why that is because if you go below 50%, you're creating a net negative sell pressure, or you're creating a net sell pressure on the Rune asset if you have like the POL getting engaged at 40% or 30% or 10% or whatnot. And so every time somebody's adding like $1 worth of savings of Bitcoin to the network or whatever, we're creating like, you know, $1.2 of sell pressure on the Rune asset, which is obviously nothing we would like to see. So we have to allow the savers to go to basically occupy up to like 50% of the pool depth before we can start enabling the POL. So that's a lot of space between now and then. I mean, that's we're right now at 2.5% of synth utilization in the Bitcoin pool. To go from 2.5% to like 50% is like, you know, a large distance. So we'll just kind of sit on POL for now and not really do anything with it. It's in the code, it's ready to go, it's been tested, all these things. And then when we feel like it's the pools need it, then we'll start looking at implementing it or enabling it more accurately.
Yep, makes sense. Last thing we want is to see some problems going on with the reserve or like the reserves are like losing Rune for some reason or, you know.
Right. That's why we have these kind of like soft launches in a sense, right? We kind of like to launch features with a soft launch just in case there's something going wrong or whatever. You're more likely to find those kind of, you know, bugs in the first few days or first few weeks or whatever. And with every day or every week, whatever, your likelihood of having some significant bug goes down, statistically speaking. So we like to start soft, start small in the beginning, and then kind of let the new feature prove itself, prove it that everything works the way we think it should work and as expected, and then, you know, let things go crazy later on.
So there's some questions from the comments. So first, what is the initial cap on the BTC savings vault? So the cap would be the synthetic utilization cap, which I believe is at 30%. And I believe the current utilization, the Bitcoin utilization is normally around like 2 or 3%. So there is still many millions that could be added to the Bitcoin savers vault. So the cap is probably somewhere around like, I don't know, like 10 or 12 million or something like that, just off like, you know, in my head math. If I had to guess a number, probably somewhere around there. It is, you know, probably north of 10 million that can be added to the Bitcoin savers vault before POL needs to be enabled. And once POL needs to be enabled, it's not exactly limitless, but it's practically limitless. So you should be able to add any amount to the Bitcoin savers vault, and the protocol and liquidity will basically take the other side of that deposit to make sure there's always space to add to that vault.
Yeah, initially, like we wouldn't actually use the POL until we get to that 50% of the pool depth. You said 30% before, which is relative to the asset depth, 15% relative to the pool depth.
Okay, yeah.
And this is my fault for confusing. Like long ago, I wrote the code in a way that was a little bit confusing for people, and that's just I'll take the blame for that one. But like,
right, that was there's a recent change, right, from pool depth to asset depth now. Okay,
right, we went from asset depth to pool depth, right? Just to, it's easier to reason about.
Gotcha.
So right now the synth cap's at 15%. And so before we can even enable the POL, that synth cap, we want to push up to at minimum 50%, at least in my opinion, that's true. And so right now it's 15%. So, and we are using 2.5% utilization in the Bitcoin pool. So, you know, we got like 12.5%, you know, of space for savers to use when we launch the feature, you know, next week or whatever. And then if it hits that cap, hit the 15%, well, then we can go ahead and we can push, the nodes can push it from 15% synth cap to, you know, 20% or 30% or some number, whatever that's going to be. Let's call it 30% for the discussion. And then we can see that gives more space, more savers can, you know, dump in. And then maybe we hit that 30% cap. Okay, now we can kind of push it to 50%. All right, we hit the 50%. Now, you know, we don't want to keep on moving the synth cap all the way up to 100% because that would be irresponsible. Now, at that point, we talk about the POL, and then we can enable the POL so that it can go beyond that marker. And then the POL just manages it from that point on.
Hey, I brought you up, Awais, the guy, the alien guy. What's up, man?
Hello. I can't believe like I'm allowed to speak for the first time in an crypto.
You don't let you speak at home?
No, yeah. Speak at home, but like this is a big for me. I'm speaking.
Welcome.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
What you got?
I'm holding Rune for like for a long time. I have made enough money from Rune, and I just love this coin.
Hell yeah, bro! Cheers for my rec. See ya.
Let's go.
Yeah.
All right. Strong statement.
Cool.
Chad, back to the synth cap. Can you speak to like how 50%? I mean, 50% sounds kind of crazy, right? Because weren't we hearing for so long like, oh, is it safe to go from 10% to 15%? And now we're talking about like 50%, which would mean like the it's basically, if you ignore the Rune half, then there's the same amount of synth liability as there is asset in the pool, right? So what, like, can you kind of explain like the safety of going up to 50%?
Yeah, sure. So beyond the 50% marker, like if we were to go to higher than that, the POL pushes it, kind of controls it. Like we didn't have the POL before to control this kind of like synth utilization at all. And so if things go in a direction we don't like, the POL is there to support it. Right, to like to bring it back to sanity in a sense. That's basically the difference between then and now, is that the synth cap would just kind of like hit some sort of a number, like let's just say hit the cap of like 30% or whatever the hell the number would be, or 15%, doesn't matter. And then all of a sudden the Rune price dives, right, for some reason, and the asset price goes up for some reason. We would surpass that 15% cap and would go to, you know, 20% to 30% to 40%. You know, as far as the market would push it. And that becomes problematic because you don't want to get to a situation where you're like at 100% or over 100%, because then you're basically the synthetic assets itself become in a form depegged. Like they're not, like one synthetic BTC is no longer equal to one synthetic BTC. It's not equal to like 0.9 something 8 real BTC. So you don't want to get over 100% relative to the pool depth of the synth, because that would just be, you would no longer have enough value in the pools to back the value of the synthetics at that point. But the POL, since it's there to act and like to take a stronger position when it needs to, it's always there to support the synthetic holders as they need to. And we didn't have that ability or that functionality before. So we were worried about the scenario where like Rune dives for some wacky reason and, you know, Bitcoin goes up for some other reason, whatever. So there was something there to support the system. The POL is there to support the system, and we have that kind of backing in a sense to support the network if the network was needed support.
Cool. Yeah, makes sense.
There's some more questions in the comments. The first is, do the Sabres vaults use Tor stablecoin as a kind of unit of account on the back end? Sabres vaults don't use anything with Tor. It's just Bitcoin and whatever other asset you're using. There's no kind of Tor stable unit of account or stablecoin involved in the Sabres vaults. It's just synthetic assets that are locked in a vault. So.
Yeah, that's correct. But there is technically speaking, the network is using a Tor-like system now, sort of. But like, right now, I think there's some sort of like minimum outbound fee, I think, of like, you know, I think it's $1 or something like this. It was just there to support the cost of threshold signatures and how they're more expensive on network than internal transactions. And so that's basically using a series of stablecoin pools to get the price of, you know, Rune, or the price of, you know, the dollar price of Rune, and then be able to set a minimum price of $1 for outbound transactions. And the Tor asset is basically using that same system that's already being used now. It's just you didn't have to burn and mint an asset. So we're not burning or minting any assets. There's no stablecoin here or anything like that. But the kind of the price oracle mechanism built into the network itself is actually it's already live, and it already interfaces with mainnet today. There's just no Tor asset itself.
Cool. Any questions? Anyone want to come up and ask about Savers Vaults? Looking at the comments too to see if there's any other. How will Savers Vaults affect the Rune price? We kind of went through this last week. If you want to go listen to the recording of how Savers Vault, it's not actually the Savers Vault itself that affects the Rune price. It's the minting of synthetic assets that affects the Rune price. And the too long didn't listen to it. Explanation of what happens to Rune is when people deposit into the Savers Vault, there's a net Rune buy pressure, and when people withdraw from the Savers Vault, there's a net Rune sell pressure. So people deposit, I'm not saying it'll increase the price of Rune, but there's a net pressure to, push towards the Rune side there. And then when you withdraw, there is a net sell pressure on the Rune asset in that pool. So listen to last week's video. It's on YouTube. You can check it out on the Nine Realms YouTube channel. So if you're curious about the price dynamics there, there's a diagram that'll help you visualize what happens in the pools and why there's buy and sell pressure. Bringing up Juggernaut. Hey, Juggernaut.
Hello. You there?
Hey, everyone.
Hey.
It's okay?
Hey, Juggernaut.
Hey. First, I'm very happy to those Bitcoin voids without Rune exposure are waiting like long time. Okay.
I'm very happy to.
Okay, that's better. So Bitcoin Vault and other assets that without Rune exposure are waiting things long time. Okay, and for me it shows one thing very, very, very important. It's the importance of synthetics, because without synthetics nothing of this is possible. Okay, this is just a reflection. I got a question, but I'm sorry, it's not about the subject of today, but there is never a bad time for brainstorming, okay? I like Osmosis for one thing, very, very nice. It's you can pay fee with the asset you want, okay? I know I'm talking with very, very high wallets, but for low wallets, it's very interesting to imagine I got $1,000 in BUSD. I want to buy it. I can't because I didn't have it to pay the transaction. This is absurd. It's the same defect that you found in Uniswap, for example. It's same. Is it a way? Is it technically possible? And is there a way, even if it makes two transactions, for example, a bit of the BUSD converted in it, to pay the transaction, is it a way to correct this, to make like Osmosis and let people choose with which token they want to pay fee? It's for me, it's the only lack of Tor chain, because it's near to the perfection. The perfection doesn't exist, but it's just some things can be facilitated like this. I don't know if it's possible, but just a question. Thank you.
Sorry, which fee do you want to choose with the asset to pay in? I missed that part.
For example, if I got BUSD, I want to buy it, but on my wallet I don't have it. I don't have any Ethereum, so I can't pay the transaction. This is
you don't need ETH in that example. You would need some BNB.
Yeah, if you swap on Thorchain currently, so you have BUSD, you don't need any ETH to make that transaction. You need a little bit of BNB for gas to send it out. But you don't actually need the destination asset at all to make a swap on Thorchain. It just takes the gas out of the original asset. So it would just take it out of the BUSD, for example. So I think what you're asking is already in Thorchain. You don't need to pay gas in a different chain. Gas just gets paid in whatever asset you're using initially.
Okay, perhaps I give the wrong example, but I think I'm sure that you know what I mean exactly.
I don't think we. I mean, can you give us a better example so we can understand what you mean? I'm not sure I follow, because I think we already do the thing that you're asking for, and I'm just trying to understand. Maybe we're missing something.
I mean, the only time I can think of where you might get stuck there is if you're swapping from an ERC-20 or a BEP2 asset that's supported by Thorchain, but it's not the gas asset. Is that what you're referring to? Like, if you're, what you described is honestly like one of the really beautiful parts of the design of Thorchain. Like, you only need the from asset. You don't need to, because a lot of bridges, you run into the problem you're describing. You like get to the other chain, but then you don't even have the asset to like, you can't even get started. It's like you already need the asset that you're trying to get. It doesn't make any sense. That's kind of one of the great things that Thorchain already solves.
Okay. Perhaps I missed something. Huh? So,
I think what's different about Osmosis, and this might be the reason why you're thinking what you're thinking, is that like when you do a transaction on Osmosis, you actually don't need the Osmo token, I think, because you can opt to make your transaction feeless. Where you just say, I don't want to pay anything for gas, in which case validators can choose to process that transaction or not. And there's some percentage of validators who will process, you know, feeless transactions, and some that will not. And so it'll eventually get picked up once enough blocks have gone by. And so if you wanted to swap something, you don't necessarily need the Osmo token, I think. But even the relayers used IBC, I think those fees associated with that, the gas fees associated with that, are paid by the relayer and not by the person making the, you know, sending the funds across that wire. Maybe that's what you're talking about. I'm not really sure.
I don't know if you remember, but it was when Terra was something interesting, a bit same. In the past, choose Luna or UST to pay transaction. Okay. In Osmosis, you can choose anything you want to pay fees. Okay.
Paying with a third asset. Like if you're sending in a BUSD to ETHSwap and paying the gas fees in Bitcoin or something like that.
Yeah. Or any asset to any other. If I got a bag of BUSD, but I want something and an RC20 asset, okay? But I don't have it to pay this transaction, which will pass by aggregators, okay?
So the problem here is that these transactions that you're referring to are happening on external chains like Ethereum or whatnot, and we don't have the ability to influence or change the behavior of an external chain. If you wanted to say, if we had like on Thorchain, we had Rune and we had Tor and we had Synthetics, so we had like various assets, and you wanted to pay your transaction fees in any of those three assets or whatever, that we could do and probably will do most likely. But we can't control how other chains function or work. And so if you're going to make an ERC-20 transaction, you need to pay gas and ETH. There's just no way around that. There's nothing anybody can do about it other than just talking to Vitalik and asking him to change how this blockchain works.
Okay.
And even if you're using, like, if you're using the aggregator on like ThorSwap or something like that, if you're swapping Bitcoin to SHIB, you still don't need ETH in your own wallet. Like, that's all happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, but you need Bitcoin in your wallet to pay for the gas.
Yes,
Bitcoin.
And then you have Bitcoin because that's what you're swapping from.
Or even if you have a wallet on Ethereum that only has ERC-20s and has zero ETH in it, then that ERC-20 is basically locked up, right? You can't do anything with it, right? So we're not really, there's nothing we can really do about that. I mean,
well, sorry to interject here, but I think Juggernaut has an interesting point, because I mean, Thorchain is the swapping mecca of places. Why not swap whatever asset you have to whatever is needed to pay the gas fee? So you end up, the user basically pays the gas fee, and let's say they have Bitcoin, and in the background that gets swapped for ETH, and the gas fee gets paid in ETH, but the user doesn't have to know about this at a premium.
But you have to have Bitcoin.
Whatever asset
you're sending into the network, you have to have gas in that asset, or the gas asset of that chain. Like, nothing we can do about that. There's nothing we can do.
Like, I'm swapping an ERC token, but I don't have ETH. I want to do a transaction, and the ETH network says no gas, so no transaction. But isn't it possible for Thorchain to take some of the asset that I already have in the background, swap it for ETH, and then offer the ETH network?
Can't do that. The answer is no.
Well, you're basically describing two swaps, right? I mean, if you have Bitcoin, you could swap some Bitcoin to ETH, and then you'd have ETH to swap your ERC-20.
Yeah, and Thorchain, I think the Thorchain ecosystem would benefit because that's more swaps. That's better fees and whatnot.
I mean, not if you're doing micro swaps of, like, you know, $2 worth of gas. That's not really going to help anybody much. But, like,
I guess
I just think it's an interesting point. I want to give props for Juggernaut for.
I guess in theory, a UI could be like, oh, hey, looks like you have no ETH, but we see you have BNB. Do you want to do a swap, like a second swap, and get gas or whatever? Like a UI could maybe interject something like that, but it would just be two Thorchain swaps.
Right.
Good brainstorming. Thank you. That was it. You guys, as always, great work. Thank you.
How's it going?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Juggernaut. Arno, are you excited for Doge Saber Vault?
out the door.
They lost him. Or maybe he's still here.
I brought up Preston. Hey, Preston.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I was just going to say that the previous gentleman, it sounds more like an application layer sort of issue or question rather than a protocol issue.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, agreed.
Because the application would have to make two swaps. First one to provide gas for itself, and then make a second swap, whatever that would be.
Correct. Yeah. And they could find the optimal way to do that across many vectors, yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to sign twice, but yeah, I mean, I suppose a wallet or a UI could look at what wallet you have connected and make a suggestion like that.
I mean, it'd be relatively expensive just because you'd have to pay gas to do the first swap. You'd have to pay the outbound fees and swap fees. Then you get some, you know, small amount, some dust amount of, you know, ether to make the has to have enough for gas on the second swap. But then all of a sudden the ether price changes, or the gas price for ether changes rather, and now you need more G-Way. Okay, now you make a second trade for gas. Okay, now you have enough. Now you make a third trade, just make the trade that you're trying to get. And this becomes, you know, overtly complicated and you know, it would probably be a bad UX, to be honest.
I don't know. I would argue that that's kind of how it is already, right? Like, all that we can do, like, I think what he was really trying to say, and I completely actually agree with what he's saying, is like the user experience should be much more seamless. And I agree, like, if you were to guesstimate on the first transaction and you were wrong, then you have to buy more ETH. I've done that 100 times at least. So it's definitely something that should be extrapolated out at the application layer in the future, especially as wallets and things of that nature get more complicated or you know, easier to use.
Right. But if the app gets it wrong, then the user's upset with the UI, the app, because, like, oh, you tried to get the amount of ether that you needed, the G-Way you needed, and you didn't get enough, you asshole. But if you did it, Preston, then you'd be like, oh, you know, I got it wrong. I got to do it again. Like, you wouldn't be as mad about yourself. Like, you know, you're pissed off at ThorSwap for getting the calculation wrong, whatever. In reality, there's no idea what the G-Way costs are going to be in, you know, 5 minutes. It could fluctuate up or down.
Yeah, I was using Stargate the other day, and they actually had the same exact feature, which I'm sure is like, you know, what some of these guys are thinking of, where it's like, you know, you're converting like USDC from one chain to another, but it also, like, there's also an option that'll just send you just like just enough gas to just get it, you know, get to do an approval and to send it out. It just, like, it adds it in there. So I can totally see the use case for something like that. Brought Arno back up. Hey.
Thank you for getting me back up here. No, I have not heard about the Doge Saver wallet. I want to know more about it. But about this issue with the gas fee, what if the protocol just says, okay, or the application says, okay, it just swaps double the amount of what gas is considered to be needed, and the user ends up with some extra ETH in their wallet, whatever. But that will save you from having to do additional swap yourself. Like for people who are not all that savvy, I think that could be a nice under the hood feature. I think there could be ways to be made to where if the gas fee suddenly changes, the gas swap that was done was large enough to where to be able to accommodate that. And if the gas fee drops, then the user ends up with some extra ETH for their next swap.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty interesting to use with the aggregator, actually, because that's really where a lot of the long tail volume is likely to be in the future, where it's like, you know, if someone's doing like a Bitcoin to, well, maybe not Bitcoin's a bad example because the op return is pretty small and you wouldn't be able to fit this entire memo in. But, you know, it's some kind of way to signal that, you know, just send me just a little bit of ETH, just enough for, you know, a transaction or two of gas, but not too much. But then do the rest through the aggregator or something similar. I think that's an interesting thing to do. Yeah, good points.
Is that already built into the Pathfinder API by chance?
I don't think there's any kind of like split transaction thing. I think everything is just like all or nothing. Like there's no way to say like, oh, give me a little bit of gas and the destination asset. I think right now it's just you just get all the destination asset. But that's probably an interesting thing that could be built right into the aggregator itself. Like, you know, instead of doing that second swap, like after it goes Bitcoin to ETH, then it goes like it goes on Uni, let's say to USDC. Just say like, all right, just put most of it through Uni, and then just give me just like a little bit, just the rest. Give me some pocket change. I'll have to talk to Thorsoft about that. That sounds pretty cool.
And then where can I find about this Doge server wallet? That sounds interesting. If you can like point me at a link or.
Yeah, so like we've been talking about it like the entire time, pretty much. It's the Bitcoin Savers wallet, but it'll be available for all gas assets, including the Doge on Thorchain, you know, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, Avex, Atom, you know, you name it. So the one and only place to earn Doge on your Doge. I just know you're into that, so I just wanted to bring it up.
I love Doge. You know me. Well, hold on a second. Is that like a single-sided pooling, basically, or yeah, is it something exactly. else? Oh, got it. Well, I don't mind my Rune exposure. In fact, it makes me pretty happy. So, but I will definitely keep that in mind for my friends because there are a lot of people who are like, you know, Doge, and that's it. So, I think that'll be a cool feature that a lot of my buddies will love to test and play around with.
Yeah, that's the key difference. Is just dead simple. Like they don't have to understand Rune. They don't have to understand impermanent loss. They don't have to understand any of that stuff. They just need to deposit some Doge and then come back later and withdraw more Doge, basically.
Yeah, it would suck for them to miss out on the Rune action. But again, having the option is fantastic. And maybe down the road, once they like, oh, I'm doing this, that's cool. But, you know, yeah, having the option to experiment later, I think that's a good move too.
Yeah, if your friends are tapped into Rune, then they know what's up. But for the probably many Doge holders are on coming from the Robin Hoods of the world and stuff, and it's a pretty cool option for them.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, it'll be available in Thor Wallet and Thor Swap real soon. So
sweet. Well, guess what? I'll be dabbling with it. Thank you guys. I'm gonna drop off again. I appreciate you guys being open to discussing this brainstorming idea that Juggernaut brought. I think that openness and that kind of clarity for chain really super awesome. And I'm a fan.
Thanks, guys. Anyone else want to come up? Is there any other questions or comments that people want to add? Been a great space today, so thanks everyone for coming out. Thanks for hanging out on a Friday.
Avex Ag on ThorSwap should be live like any time at this point, so that's kind of cool.
Oh shit!
Well, that's awesome.
Feature after feature right now. It's like triple launch days.
I sounded kind of disappointed.
I mean, it's just the Avex Ag. I know it's not. There we go.
There you go.
All right, let's wrap it up. Thanks everyone for coming out. Yeah, next. I guess we'll see you guys next Friday. and hopefully we'll see some Savers UIs online before then, and we'll get Yield turned on, and we'll get this party rolling a little bit.
Yeah, let's do it.
Great energy, by the way. I love everyone still coming out to these things and, you know, asking questions and, like, you know, just coming to hang out with the Thorchain community. So it's been fun.
100%. Always fun.
See you next week. See you in the Discords.
See ya.